Hi, everyone, and welcome again to the Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast. We have a relatively small show, actually, this week. There's only bits of news. There's not a huge amount of cricket being played, although we have an interview with the German Development Officer for Women's Cricket, Monica Loverday, which we included. But to join me for the news section is my regular co-host, Andrew Dixon. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Russ. Hi, everybody.
Andrew, let's start with the ICC news. The TV deal has been signed for the next 8 years. When the Big Three made their challenge to the existing structures of cricket, they projected that it will be a $2.5 billion deal, and that meant that everyone would be floated forward, even though some would be lifted significantly more than others. The deal itself is $1.98 billion, though, which essentially means that although the BCCI is doing significantly better, as well as ECB and Cricket Australia, for most of the nations of the world, the sum of money they're getting is pretty much where they were. And for associate nations, the relevant figures here, the top six, if they go with what they were proposing in the document that was put forward, the top six will probably be about $30 or $40 million over the next 8 years better off between the six of them. So that's about maybe $800,000 a year each. But the rest of the world is probably going to end up roughly where they are now, and we still don't know what's going to happen with the regional offices, and obviously the events have been peeled back. So it appears that the result of this TV deal is probably a net negative for associate cricket, because once you get outside the top six, it seems like the money's probably disappearing a little bit.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way, and it's disappointing. Your $2.5 billion projected figure was perhaps a little optimistic. After all, the new TV deal includes less World 2020 tournaments. It's now only been taking part every 4 years rather than every 2 years, which obviously reduces the value of the deal a little bit, with 2020 being so popular. And if, you know, as you say, the associates and affiliates below the top six are getting the same amount as they were before, that means proportionally they're getting less than they were previously, which again is disappointing. Yeah, and the regional offices, the regional events, we've no idea what's going on there. Hopefully eventually some of this will come out. We'll get to know. We'll certainly find out once we see the schedule perhaps for 2016 for regional tournaments. Obviously with there not being no World 2020 in 2018, there's going to be no World 2020 qualifying events on a regional basis, we assume. So whether we could see perhaps very few tournaments in 2016, and that will be our first sign of what impact this has had on associate and affiliate cricket, I think.
Yeah, that'll be particularly interesting. You'd hope that they'll fill in some sort of tournament, even if it's not actually a qualifier. But obviously, without that pathway that's direct that there is at the moment, it's hard to see what they might do. And it wouldn't surprise us if, given recent events, if there isn't any cricket at all.
Yeah, it's very sad to say. You only need to go back a few years, and you were seeing, you know, some tournament, some regions on their own having 12, 13, 14 tournaments, and now we're lucky if we get that many regional tournaments combined in a year.
One thing we might see is a consequence of not having as much money is that it, obviously if the top six associates do that, they'll be able to contract more players, but those players, if they're good enough, will also be drawn towards the domestic leagues of the world, the T20 leagues, as we've seen in West Indies cricket. And West Indies, I think, is a good example. Even though they're getting substantially more than the associate nations, but about five times more, they still are in this position where they can't set up a working relationship with their players because their players can earn more not operating within the national system. And again, the cricket's structural issues have not been resolved in any way.
Yeah, I think, you know, see, as we're recording this, West Indies tour of India has been cancelled due to a dispute with players. It's perhaps a symptom of a wider problem within cricket, that the structure of it has been at breaking point for a while, and it seems that, you know, these 2020 leagues and the IPL especially has been the breaking point, and we're seeing more things like this. The West Indies is a main example. It also has a knock-on effect. the Kevin Peterson situation with England is also a part of this. You know, his desire to play in the IPL ahead of playing in county cricket sort of contributed to him being sacked from the England side eventually. And part of it is that you have this structure of international cricket now. You have the teams touring all the time with no real context to it. You can see what the players, why not accept big money for 6 weeks in a 2020 tournament, domestic tournament, that has a lot of context and meaning that you use, as we've said on this show before, a beginning, a middle and end, ahead of playing in a series that has very little meaning and for less money. And I think it's all about this structure of international cricket we've got, and it's at a breaking point, and it doesn't seem to be changing.
That's right, and I think this is a problem for associates going forward as well, in the sense that because it's at breaking point, it's very difficult to see how they can fit into it, and it probably needs reforming before that's even considered, even for a team that's obviously doing well like Ireland.
There's this theoretical pathway to test cricket now through the Intercontinental Cup, which Ireland and certainly Afghanistan are quite keen to take advantage of. But they could get there into that pathway into test status and have nobody wanting to play them. And indeed, no test matches to play. Never mind, not even people who wanted to play them. There might not be test cricket as we know it. It sounds a bit drastic. People have been talking about the death of test cricket since the 19th century, as people may be aware. But it's a worrying time for associate cricket in general, and cricket in general, to be honest. And it's going to be a interesting few years to see what happens with the new TV deal and whatnot, whether any, you could well see your boards at full member level starting to go bust, and it's a worrying time.
Yeah, that's another good point. Zimbabwe is already on the verge of that. And it won't help, obviously, Test Cricket, that the Test Cricket Fund was going to exist only if the TV deal reached a certain size. I think that figure was $2 billion, and it doesn't appear that it's actually reached it. So, again, it seems that the things that a lot of people would really like to see supported in cricket are pretty much last in the queue in terms of getting the money.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the way cricket has been set up. It's been set up as a very much a top-down thing, where rather than try and build a base from the bottom, try and develop the game, it's all about making more money for the people at the top of the game. And we've said on this show before, people in India, Australia and England don't realise cricket is still actually a developing sport around the world. It's not. Although it's apparently the second most watched sport in the world, it's not a major sport. It's a major sport in two or three countries. And because they've not been supporting the development of the game as much as they could do, rather than and fiddling the money all towards the top of the game, then we've got themselves into this situation. It's a shame, but you could have seen it coming.
There was some relatively good news out of the ICC, though, in the last couple of weeks, that they've been developing a governance program and have piloted it with the nine nations, mostly from the European, but as well as Suriname, Uganda and Japan. Good news. It's certainly, I think, developing the governance of the various organisations is something the ICC probably is not doing, hasn't been doing enough of, and so it's good to see this sort of program starting up.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a little disappointing that countries that have poor records in governance didn't have a representative at this conference. You have no representative from Nepal, Kenya, or the USA. USA, of course, apparently been taking governance advice from the West Indies, and I'm sure that's going well at the moment. I think they seem to be giving advice the other way on how to completely screw things up. For the countries that are involved, it's very good. It's quite a wide spread of countries as well in terms of ranking. Obviously, you've got representatives from the top of the game, so Ireland and Scotland, and then people further down, like people from Argentina, Japan, and Suriname. Hopefully, this program can be expanded in future. But things like these, if money is becoming less, these are the things that will go first, unfortunately.
Speaking of Nepal, they have had some issues with governance, and the major one being that they hadn't appointed a chief executive officer and a finance manager. It's good to hear that they've in fact done so. They've appointed Bwana Gimia as the CEO, and one of the few women as well operating in cricket, which is again a good sign that they've obviously picked out their person on merit, not just someone local or from the cricket Nepal who may not necessarily be the best person going forward.
And she's already sort of set out her stall, as it were, talking about building a international quality ground in Kathmandu and trying to get Nepal to play in the Duleep Trophy in India, which would be very, very good for Nepal, playing a few first-class games in India. Would be superb. She's hoping to get ODI status in the next few years. It's obviously very ambitious for Nepali cricket, and I think she's the right person for the job, and I think will help progress Nepali cricket. It's someone different than the Nepali establishment, who many cricket fans in Nepal say haven't really been doing enough to help bring on Nepali cricket and let it fulfil the potential it so obviously has.
Conversely, there's more bad news out of Kenya, in that the national cricket team has decided to go on strike for fairly spurious reasons. It sounds like it's to do with their whether or not they have to pay tax on their earnings from cricket. Kenyan cricket is itself getting a significant reduction in income over the next couple of years, so it does seem a bit excessive for the players to not recognise this and to still be disputing pay things, which has been an ongoing problem really for the past decade.
Yeah, I suspect there must be other reasons behind this. You're reading the articles about it. They say it just sounds like they're going on strike because they have to pay tax, which is very strange. Didn't they have to pay tax before? And if not, why not? The article I've read on this goes into a bit of just what they've lost. And this is under the old structure. They've lost $1 million a year, which is quite drastic reduction. And under the new funding methodology, that could be even less. And that's a worrying sign for Cricket Kenya. They're hoping to do well in World League Division 2 in Namibia in January, and if this dispute carries on much longer, they could well find themselves struggling in that and not getting into the Intercontinental Cup and into the World Cricket League Championship, which would be even more disastrous for Kenya. Have we got some good news in this episode?
No. Yeah, we had some a second ago.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I suppose.
The answer to your question, Andrew, is we do have good news and we do have bad news. And the good news is that Nepal has organised to play in Sri Lanka, including both before the World Cricket League Division 3 and then after, to play matches against Hong Kong in T20 matches. The bad news is that it appears that the Asian Cricket Council's championship, which was to be a multi-day event, has been cancelled.
Starting with the ASC championship, was due to be held in December in the UAE, featuring the top 4 teams from the ASC Premier League, so Nepal, Afghanistan, UAE and Oman. They would be playing 2-day matches. I'm not a fan of 2-day cricket, but it's better than 1-day cricket, I suppose, in the sense of developing players' skills, helps them build innings and whatnot. But it looks like it's been cancelled because Afghanistan and UAE have had something scheduled for them by the ICC, which we don't know what it is yet. This does seem to be becoming a habit for the ICC scheduling things to clash with ACC regional events. So we saw Afghanistan's World Cup preparation sort of clash with the Asian Games cricket tournament. And this is a worrying sign given what we were talking about earlier about the drop-off in regional events. The ICC is scheduling things to clash with them now and causing them to be cancelled, and that could be a sign for the future that the ICC are going to do all the scheduling now and not worry about the regional events. But, as we say, good news from Nepal that they're getting these matches in Sri Lanka, first as preparation for the World Cricket Division 3, and then perhaps more importantly, is the tour that happens after World Cricket League Division 3, where they'll play a Sri Lanka board 11 in a couple of three-day games, then play a 2020 international series against Hong Kong and a one-day match against Hong Kong, and then Hong Kong will also play a couple of three-day matches against the Sri Lanka board 11. So that's some good news for a change for associate teams, and it's unfortunate that Afghanistan and UAE weren't also able to take advantage of the offer from Sri Lanka to host the associates, but hopefully they can in the future.
Absolutely agree on the ICC. I think this is the second time we've discussed that they seem to have organised things in a way that's prevented teams from attending events, and the Afghans and UAE, we're not quite sure what their program is, but it seems that they're going to be busy in November and December. So that's, I guess, good news, at least at one level, that this is going about. It may just be training sessions at Dubai. And I guess it's symptomatic of this stuff we were talking about earlier about cricket being just terribly disorganised, and fixturing is one of those things that's disorganised in.
No argument from me on that.
Joining us now on the podcast is the Women's Development Officer for German Cricket, Monica Lofty. Welcome on the show, Monica.
Thank you.
Monica, let's start with the tournament in Germany that was played recently. It was quite a large tournament for a national association to put on. Andrew and I spoke about it in a previous episode, but what were the highlights for you?
Well, first of all, it was brilliant to welcome all the different nations to this fantastic location. I mean, it's right next to the Olympic Stadium in Berlin, and that was just brilliant to see the teams get together there. That was one highlight, certainly. Personally, a highlight was, I have to say, beating Jersey for the first time. We have been playing them now third year in a row, and it was the first time we beat them, so that was a personal highlight.
And Germany did quite well. They came second to Italy. Do you feel that you can surpass them soon?
Yeah, I think we didn't have our best game against Italy, but otherwise we played quite well against Gibraltar. That wasn't quite as good. Could have done better there. I mean, we beat them, but it was quite tight in the end. But certainly Italy, on a better day for us, it would have been a tighter game than it was.
And did any particular players impress you?
Certainly, Rebecca Blake from France is a very talented player. I saw her first time last year. And she has improved a lot in the last 12 months. So I think she will improve even further. She's very talented. From our team, I just have admiration for our captain, Stefanie Frohnmayr. She actually broke her middle finger off her bowling hand the day before the tournament in the last training session. And she still opened the bowling and batted, and she took her wickets and scored runs. I don't know how she did it, but she did really brilliantly.
And younger players as well, are you noticing over the last few years that teams have been improving? I think this is the second time this tournament's been run, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the younger players, I mean, we had a number of younger players. Some of them, two or three of them, only started sort of in the national team setup this year. And they really came along nicely. They gained a bit of experience of playing at that setup, at that standard, and they did really well. I mean, we've got players from a little village in the north of Germany. They're being coached by a Kiwi, and he's turned sort of the whole village into cricket mad players. So that's really a joy to watch, especially those the young girls. They are 14. They're playing under 15 boys of county setup as well, so it's really good to see.
And did the tournament attract any local media attention?
Not as much as we hoped to. I mean, we did issue, or the DCB issued press releases beforehand, but it's really hard in a country where cricket is widely unknown to get coverage. So that was a bit disappointing.
And is women's cricket harder to promote than men's cricket as well, or it's all much modest in Germany?
Yeah, it's pretty much the same, unless you've got good connections with the media, local media. I mean, don't even talk about national or regional, just local media. It's the same for the men or the women. It's really hard to get coverage. Maybe a bit more so for the youth, but otherwise it is really hard.
Looking at the standard of the tournament that was played there, I'm not sure how familiar you are with, say, the gap to the Netherlands and Scotland, but is continental Europe progressing towards that level, do you think?
Yes, I think it's progressing really nicely, and it's already, in the last 12 months, it made a huge step, considering that at our level, it's all the stuff is voluntary, so it shows the hard work and the commitment by the players and the staff. I mean, there is still a gap towards Netherlands and Scotland, no doubt about it. But it is progressing, and hopefully we'll get there.
And I guess the follow-up to that is, would you then like to see the winner of a tournament like this be playing in official ICC tournaments, or would you like this tournament to be an official ICC second division, for instance?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's something we talked about, that it's our wish would be that the ICC would set up a Division 2 tournament, an official ICC tournament, and for the winner to go up to Division 1, exactly. At the moment in Division 1, it's only the Netherlands, Scotland, Ireland. So, and they're played a week after our tournament. And because it's only the three teams, they're playing each other two or three times in the same tournament in 3 or 4 days. So I think it's really time that other countries are given at least a chance to go up to that level. I mean, teams will only improve if they play against stronger opposition.
Is that something that you think will happen shortly, or is it something that you've talked to the ICC Europe about?
Well, we had a short discussion about it, but of course it's all the financial issue there that ICC Europe has to see a return for their money if they want to do that. Or if they're willing to do that. How far they are willing to do that, I don't think it will happen in the next, 2 years or so. I don't see it happen. As much as I wish for it, I don't see it happen. I wish that they would do it, but as I say, financial issues play a major part.
I guess the final question there is, how important is a tournament like this in terms of promoting to women within Germany and other countries?
I mean, it's hugely important. If anybody was on Facebook or anything remotely to, connected to people having played there, it was just amazing, the pictures that were going around and the comments. And if we spread it through that alone, through social media, and if that attracts only a handful of women to say, oh, let's give it a try and see what it's all about, then it was all worthwhile. And it can only be for the good of women's cricket.
So, some questions about women's cricket in Germany, because I suspect most of our listeners aren't necessarily very familiar with women's cricket. It doesn't have a huge profile. Associate cricket has a small profile, and women's cricket is very small even within that. So, how is women's cricket in Germany structured? How many players are there?
How many players? I would guess female players, about 150 plus. It's structured in the same way that most other countries structured, with clubs who've got girls' teams or women's teams. We don't yet distinguish between girls and women, so usually the all-age groups play together. So in 2014, we had a club championship for the first time, which meant that clubs were playing, or the teams were playing in regional rounds, and then qualifying for final, sort of a national final. As well, at the same time, we have a kind of county championship. So the best players of a region form a team. And they play against each other, and that's over 2 days. On the Saturday, a 40-over game, and on the Sunday, a 20-over game.
I guess if this Germany is a fairly large country, is this a problem that there are so few players sort of spread out, or are they concentrated in a few areas? So you have sufficient opposition and teams to play against regularly?
Yeah, I mean, the certain areas, I mean, first of all, Germany, I know it's not as big as Australia, but in Europe, it's a fairly big country. And that is one of the issues we always have, the traveling and the infrastructure, that teams are spread apart. Certain areas are doing really well. I mean, the north of Germany, they have really dedicated clubs who do a lot of development work in terms of women's cricket. They're our strongest region. In the west, in Cologne, we've got a strong team with a couple of more teams on the breakthrough. In Berlin, we've got two teams. And the south is a bit the weakest at the moment. There's one near Munich, but that's about it. They're the weakest area. But as I say, it's all getting stronger. So it's really nice to see the development.
And one of the interesting things about women's cricket, I think in Europe generally, but Germany in particular, is that it seems to be largely played by native-born players as opposed to the men's team, which seems to be more drawn from the expat community. Is that the case, and why do you think that is?
It's definitely the case for Germany. It's difficult to say why it is. Well, no, it's not difficult. I should correct myself there. A while ago, there was a really good schools program. That was only in two or three towns, really, but there were a lot of girls coming through from there. And although, of course, teenagers stop playing and have different interests, there's a hardcore group who really kept going, who are so committed to cricket that they actually chose their university towns depending on how much cricket they could play there. We don't have as many expat players. Yeah, It's increasing a bit, but you, in the past you haven't seen as many Indian women in Germany, not in the numbers compared to the men. It is getting more because there are more, for example, Indian women who study in Germany, but it's still more native born players, definitely, in the women's game.
And do you need different strategies to work with women if you're trying to attract them to a sport that's more or less unfamiliar, as opposed to the expat community who in theory have a fairly large player pool that they can draw?
Yeah, it's just different. I mean, that's the other point for women. It's easier to start at any age. I mean, you would never get it that you've got a beginner playing in a league team at the age of 30 or 35 in a men's team. With women, it does work. And that's one of our selling points to older women, or older, I say 30 plus, who looking for a team sport to play and to take up. And there are not many team sports you can start afresh with when you're that age. Usually the handball or football you start when you're 12 or 13 and keep going until you can't play it anymore. But cricket is a sport which still older players, women, can take up and be a big part of the team. So that's one of our, one of the strong points for women's cricket, I think.
Do you have a multiple target markets when you're going out to try and promote it? Are you looking at both older players and schools, or is it just whoever can come?
I mean, of course, schools is one area to target, no doubt about it. I mean, the younger you get them, the better they can become, the better players they can become, and the more potential you can get out of them. But as I say, we don't select on any age or ability. We're happy for anybody who wants to play. They're welcome to play.
Finally, what sort of progression is in place now? I think you already spoke about briefly about the county game. Obviously, you've got the national team above that. But what are you aiming to put in place in terms of someone who takes up the sport to move through the sport in terms of making the national team, and how do you see that progressing?
Well, they would start off at their club, in the normal club cricket team. As I said, then they would go into the regional team selection, and then we start to have a German development squad, which is basically under 17, so the younger players, to get them used to set up the training that is a bit harder than what they're used to in their club, and to get them all involved there and as I say, used to a bit training that's a bit harder than what they have been doing so far. And then, of course, the national team. We hope to expand the regional leagues in future, possibly in under-15s, under-17s girls' league or tournaments in the future, because we have got quite a number of under-17 girls. But again, it's at the moment still a bit the infrastructure, they're too far apart to play regularly. So it would be one-off tournaments, for example. That's what we're hoping to do in the future.
And at individual levels, has there been any talk of, say, for just individuals who are at the national level to go to, for instance, England or overseas to develop their cricket in a different environment?
Yeah, definitely. We had an offer from Scotland to send one or two girls there, which we haven't taken up yet this year. That was a bit too soon. But we're working together with the other nations to see if we can place one or two girls there in a season so they can experience a bit higher level women's cricket and get something out of that. So that's definitely... the national team also goes on a training camp to England, or has been doing that for the first time this year. We're planning to do it again next year and play against opposition in England. So that's all to develop the team and individual players.
Let's turn to some matches, Andrew. Stick with some of these warm-up matches. Ireland and Scotland have continued their tours. I think Afghanistan might have played again since we spoke as well. They ended their tour relatively well. They won games against the Northern Districts in New Zealand and Auckland, but although they lost in one other match. Ireland, after a bit of a shaky start to their tour, came back and defeated the Australian Capital Territory in a couple of games. And we saw an exceptional match between Scotland and what is termed a New Zealand 11, although it's going to be incredibly similar to the match, to the 11 that they're going to put out for their next one day. It was really only missing Ross Taylor and Kane Williamson, who neither of whom are playing the next one day.
Yeah, very strange that this game couldn't have been classed as a one international, and it was actually good to see that New Zealand were getting the New Zealand cricket Twitter account was getting a lot of stick about this, about it not being a one international, which was extremely good to see. And it was a very good match. I managed to catch the end of it with New Zealand just about managing to win by one run. They had it was the last pairing at the wicket for the final over. But that last pairing managed to take the score from 243 to 262. So they did a very good job. Did Majid Haq and Alistair Evans, and they got close. They got close to beating a full member in a one day game, and it was pretty much a full strength full member, even though it didn't count as a one day international. Had this been a one day international, and Scotland would have won. Scotland would have entered the ODI rankings for the first time. You're disappointed for Scotland not to quite win the game, but it's very good to see them perform so well against such a strong side. But then disappointing that Ireland's game against New Zealand got completely rained off.
Yeah, there's a really fine innings as well from Matt McCann in that, and Coleman down the order. They were struggling a little bit, Scotland, in their chase, and it looked like they weren't going to get close, but McCann's 83 really dragged them forward. And I think on another day, they were run out on the final ball, Evans, and he was only really out by about a foot. But he had an opportunity a couple of balls before to knock a short ball away for the runs that would have at least tied and possibly won the match. So on another day, they might have certainly won this game, and it was a really good performance. New Zealand might say that they're still in there kind of early in the season and they're not completely prepared, but Scotland, I think in the long run, they should be aiming to be at the same level as New Zealand. They have similar kind of populations, and this is the sort of game and match that really should become a bit of a rivalry over the next couple of decades.
You're absolutely right. New Zealand are perhaps the model for teams like Ireland and Scotland, where you've got that small population and then having another sport that's much more popular. And New Zealand have managed to do well with those constraints, and I think Ireland and Scotland can learn from that, and that's the target, I think, for Ireland and Scotland, to try and be like New Zealand.
There's a few more matches in this tour. It's quite an extended tour when you consider that it began with the UAE and will finish with Ireland and Scotland playing a few more matches in Lincoln before heading home. Thoughts on the tours? I know we did touch on it in the last episode.
Again, I'm not convinced that these are the best preparations. The venues aren't the same as, for the most part, as the venues that we're playing on in the World Cup. You know, the UAE will play 4 games in New Zealand in the World Cup and didn't go to New Zealand on their tour. But you know, we covered that on the last episode. And again, you're playing against not necessarily first choice sides, although it was good to see New Zealand put up such a strong side against Scotland, as we said. You know, the sides in pre-season, so they're not taking these as seriously as they otherwise would. Which again is disappointing. When you compare it to the build-up you had for the 2007 World Cup, where the associates were playing, you know, lots of ODIs, they had a World Cricket League Division 1 tournament in Kenya, they had various tri-series, some of them were playing games against Zimbabwe and Bangladesh. The comparison with the build-up to this 2015 World Cup doesn't seem as impressive. Maybe there's something else happening. I've heard rumours of an Ireland ODI against New Zealand, funnily enough, while both are in the UAE coming up. I've heard rumours about Afghanistan and the UAE playing a ODI series. So maybe there is more in the pipeline, but these particular preparation tours I've not been too impressed with, really.
Yeah, we'll have to assume that Scotland and Ireland are going to spend quite a lot of time in the UAE over the next few months. They're obviously not going to be in season, and so their preparation for the World Cup is going to be heavily done in Dubai or in Australia or New Zealand in order to ensure that they're actually ready.
I think there's also talk that Ireland might be playing in the West Indies one-day competition again this winter. Hopefully that'll happen. Yeah. For these tours, though, I've been severely disappointed, really. I know the performance of the associate hasn't been brilliant at times, but, you know, these are warm-up games. You can't really take too much away from the results. The teams are tending to experiment and whatnot, and there's a very varied opposition as well. Hopefully there'll be something more for these teams beyond just these, you know, half a dozen matches against slightly weakened sides.
At the other end of the scale for tournaments, there was a very small tournament hosted in Colombia, between Peru, Colombia and Brazil, and it appears as if the Brazil is the strongest of the three sides, having won most of their matches. Although they did lose one match to Colombia.
Unfortunately, details of this tournament are a little thin on the ground. But it looks like Brazil have won. But it was good to see Colombia win a game. You see, Colombia, a non-ICC member at the moment. And whether or not the ICC is currently open to new applicants, we don't know. But certainly Colombia have been moving on recently in the last sort of 2 or 3 years and really trying to develop the game. They've got a couple of locals starting to pick up the game now as well, which is great to see. And in general, though, it's as we always say when these tournaments happen, it's good to see that where the ICC isn't providing regional tournaments, that the countries themselves are stepping up and organising their own tournaments.
Joining us now on the Association for Cricket podcast is Chris Hodgson, the Secretary of Cricket Peru. Welcome, Chris.
Hello, Russ.
Chris, we wanted to talk about the tournament that was in Colombia that Peru participated in along with Brazil. How did the event go? The scores indicated that they were both very close matches and some particularly high-scoring matches.
It was really good. Really good event. So I don't know if you know, but it was kind of the first time that Colombia had been involved in international cricket for a few years now. The scene there kind of died back a bit in recent years, and they're just kind of getting it going again. So this was like them sort of dipping their toe back into the water of the South American scene. And it was the first time that we'd been over to Colombia as well, which is cool. And so we did a mini tournament, Colombia, Peru and Brazil. And it was a really good tournament, aside from the fact that we didn't make the final. Three good games, as you say, high scoring, very close. So Colombia just pipped us in the first game. We looked like we were going to win it. And then We had a bit of a batting collapse the last couple of overs, and they snatched it. And then the final between Brazil and Colombia, again, Colombia batted well, put quite a lot of runs on the board, I think 150-odd. And then kind of Brazil showed their experience, really, and chased it down. Fairly comfortably in the end, but... yeah, good game and good games and a good tournament, really. Everybody really enjoyed it, so a success.
And did any players or performances stand out, particularly, I guess, young players or players that are maybe looking to develop in the future?
Ooh. Probably not on our side, no. I mean, the big standout player would be Brazil's opening bat, a guy called Greg Casey, who captains them now. I think he made a 50 in every single game, so he was far and away like the tournament top scorer. He definitely took the game away from us when we played them. Aside from that, Colombia had a couple of good young guys. They had a good opening bat who's an English bloke. He's only 22, 23, I think. Guy Mike Phillips, he played well. But I mean, really, for Colombia, like, they were all new. It was the first tournament they played, and they acquitted themselves very, very well. They all batted very well and bowled well, and were a very well organised outfit.
And the facilities in Colombia, what's the standard like there?
They were good. So we played at a place called the Bogota Sports Club, which is just outside the centre, so it's kind of in the outskirts suburbs of Bogota. And I think that's like an old expat club, basically, which is used more for football now than cricket. But they've got a concrete wicket with a mat on top, which a few people were a little bit apprehensive about beforehand, kind of how much it was going to kick up. But actually played quite nicely. And it came through quickly, but quite nicely onto the bat. And so that was good. You know, they had the outfield very nice and short. I mean, it was great. You know, it was a bit much better than a lot of pitches I played on back in England. And yeah, nice little clubhouse. The one eye-catching thing about it, or rather breathtaking thing about it, is that the ground is actually Bogota is in the Andes. So the ground is kind of outside of Bogota, so it's higher than Bogota again. So I think it's at 2,000 meters, which is quite significant. Like, you really feel it when you play, and definitely when we first warmed up on the first morning, like, we were really short of breath, having only run kind of 20 meters. Not that we can run much further than that without getting out of breath, of course, but we definitely felt it playing. It kind of added an extra dimension. They say that the ball travels faster through the air because of the thinner air, so it's easier to hit sixes. Fortunately, our team didn't really hit too many sixes, but certainly seemed like the Brazilians managed to hit them quite well, and Colombia as well, actually. It's quite a lot of dramatic batting.
That explains the high scores, I guess, with a lot of
sixes. Yes, could be.
And was it played under ICC eligibility rules? And to what extent was there local players amongst the three teams? Non-expats, I guess.
So ICC eligibility, you know, you need 7 years residency in the country or, you know, be born there or have a passport. So no, it wasn't, is the short answer. But actually, probably from our team, probably most of the guys who played for us would qualify, but we didn't have any proven born players with us, unfortunately. They're a bit trickier. The foreign tours are a bit trickier because we have to finance them ourselves. You know, the players have to pay for them themselves. So really, speaking for Peru, we just open it up to whoever's able to come and whoever can get the time off work and all that sort of thing. Brazil had a couple of Brazilian guys, and you know, again, a lot of guys who've been there for years and would qualify for ICC and have played in ICC tournaments before. Colombia, they had a Colombian. Actually, they did have a Colombian on their team who's great, very nice chap. He'd learned his cricket in Belgium, he's telling me. But aside from that, yeah, it's mainly expats. I think for all of us, we all have local players kind of playing in domestic cricket. But they're not quite at the level yet to be playing these sorts of competitions where it stands a little bit higher.
I guess that's a good segue into cricket in Peru. So how many teams are there at the moment, and are they spread out throughout the country, or are they focused within Lima?
Yeah, in Peru, we've got 5 teams at present. We're going to go to 6 teams next year, so our new season starts in January. So they're all based in Lima. There's also a little bit of cricket gets played in a place called Tacna, which is right on the border with Chile. That's because there's an expat community down there of guys who it's a free trade zone, so there's a lot of imports and exports. So it's guys who are involved in the import trade down there. But they're closing that free trade loophole, and actually quite a lot of the expats are moving. So unfortunately, that's dying out as a little bit of area. But there's still a little bit of cricket down there, and they always send a team up to Lima once a year to play against kind of a Lima side, which is always quite keenly contested. But most of it, well, practically all of it now is focused on Lima. I mean, from a development point of view, administration point of view, it probably makes life a little bit easier, to be honest, because we're not having to spread ourselves so thinly. We can concentrate our efforts on the same facilities. We can get everyone together easily in terms of introducing it to locals and stuff. It's that much easier. But, yeah, hopefully, and, not too far down the line, we'll have teams in other parts of Peru. But for the time being, no, it's all Lima-based.
And I know there's some junior development going on. The under-13 team played recently in Argentina. How did that tournament go, and what is the state of junior development in Peru?
They did, yeah. So they just got back. And also under-17s as well. It's like a double tournament, under-13s and under-17s. Cricket's quite well anchored in Argentina, relatively speaking. They've got like 8 or 9 country clubs where it's been played for like 100 years. So when we play against Argentinians, when the youth teams play against Argentina, it's great for them to see like Latin kids playing cricket, and because they do it in Spanish, and it's kind of normal to them to be playing cricket, and they aren't kind of talking in English, or it's not some weird foreign game for them. So it's always really nice for our Peruvian kids to see kind of what cricket could be like in Peru in a few years' time, and in terms of what you can do with a bat and ball as well, because they're always a great example to our lot. There were some very talented cricketers there. Reports were a successful tournament. We came second. We were runners-up. So I'm pretty pleased with that, but we actually won the tournament the year before. So disappointed not to defend the title. It's actually a shame we did the interview 2 weeks ago, because I could have told you we were the reigning under 13 champs, but unfortunately we're not anymore. Yeah, in terms of youth development out here, we have a program teaching in schools. So we've got cricket in a few schools now. I mean, 6 years ago there was nothing. Absolutely no young people in Peru playing cricket at all, or even knew what cricket was. And now, as I say, we've got a program established in 2 or 3 schools, which is good, and it's great. And as I say, we won the tournament last year, and that's a nice flag in the ground, a nice little marker to see how far we've come. But we're really kind of at the next stage now. We want to take it out of basically the expat circle, because in the schools that we're teaching it, they're international schools, so they're schools that teach English, and they're schools where we have links, right, where some of the teachers play cricket or parents might play cricket or whatever, and some of the kids, might spend time in England and have a little bit of an understanding of cricket. So that's kind of been stage one, and stage two is what we're kind of embarking on now, we're launching a program in one of the districts in Lima called Magdalena, and we've partnered with the local municipality, the council, to launch a cricket scheme there, and we've got a few kickoff events where everybody comes down and they have a bit of a cricket experience and chuck a ball around and hit a few balls and do a bit of fielding, and we'll give them a few sausages and stuff as a thank you. And then we're going to start a cricket school on the back of that. So we're quite excited about this, actually, because it's quite a big thing for us, for Cricket Peru, in that we're going into communities where there's no link at all, no English or no expat connection and no understanding of what cricket is already. So it's a big project, ambitious, but we're confident that we can make it a success, and we're definitely looking forward to that.
And how do you perceive that going? I guess you're going to introduce cricket into the schools. Are you then going to start junior teams, or is it a couple of steps further past that?
So we already have junior teams. Mm-hmm. So we've got, as I say, so we've already got it running in three schools, and we also have a program that we run where we play in Lima as a club called the Lima Cricket Club. And that's kind of like a country club sort of setup. And we also have a cricket school there, so members, kids of members can come and play there. So we already have kind of four little pools of youth cricket, and we have tournaments between them, and we've already got kind of organised youth tournaments. But as I say, they're among populations that have a connection to the expat world. So the Cricket Magdalena idea is that we're taking out that, and these are just kind of like everyday normal Peruvians. So in terms of how confident we are, it's a step into the unknown. But we've had a lot of support from the council so far. They've been really encouraging, and they've been great in putting us in touch with schools and promoting it and giving us everything that we need really to make it a success. So I guess check back on in 6 months, but hopefully, as I say, we're quietly confident that, that it'll be a success, and that we can build something sustainable and you know, continue growing, because there's certainly a lot of scope for growth. I know that much.
Yeah, that's a good lead into my next question, which is where does someone take the cricket within Peru if they're a junior player at the moment? Where do you hope that they can take it in terms of, I guess, playing for the national side, but also potentially playing cricket outside Peru or something like that?
Well, we have one guy, I don't think that we can take all of the credit, but we actually have a Peruvian who has a cricket scholarship at a school in England, a guy called Luis Paredes, and he actually flew back over to Argentina to play for the, to play in the under-13s tournament that's just happened. So he was a guy who lived a little bit in South Africa when he was a kid, so he knew what cricket was, but between the ages of 9 and 12, played his cricket with us, and it was actually through one of the South American Championships, one of the junior South American Championships, one of the guys from the other teams said to him, you know, you've got a lot of talent, and you get in touch with a couple of schools, you might find that they'd be happy to give you a scholarship, and they have. So that's great. So, I mean, he's like the real success story, of course. I don't know if we're going to be sending very many more people on cricket scholarships, but I guess what we're looking for is to build that base. So always to be growing the youth participation and the numbers we've got. And with that, of course, you know, the standard's going to be developing, and we'll have bigger and bigger junior structures, so junior leagues and all that sort of thing. And we already have, you know, a pathway in place for, you know, under-13s to under-17s to play in domestic cricket with the men and then to play in international cricket. Obviously where we'd like to be is that in 10 years time, the Peruvian national team is full of Peruvians, of course, you know, who are born and bred Peruvians, and we're not relying on expats who play their cricket elsewhere. I think it'll be a while before we're totally free of it. As I say, you know, I think we're probably looking 10, 15 years, but hopefully it's doable. And, you know, you look at Peru, it's a big country, there's a lot of people, they love sport, but all there really is in terms of organised team sport is football. So there's huge scope, I think, to get kids involved in other things, and particularly in terms of where it is socioeconomically and in terms of development. You know, there are a lot of kids that are just looking for an opportunity to do something and for some sort of organised leisure activities and sports, and if we can provide that to them, you know, we've got a huge potentially captive audience. So hopefully this Cricket Magdalena thing will be the spark that gets it all going, because, you know, I really do think the sky's the limit, so we shall see.
Returning again to the tournament in Colombia, and I guess where that can take Peruvian cricket. Obviously, it's quite a fair distance to travel to Colombia, and as you said, especially if you're paying for yourself. How important are these types of small events in terms of building up local rivalries with Brazil and others and so forth?
Yeah, they're great. So we actually have something called the South American Championships, which has been running since the mid-90s. So that was set up before kind of any of us South American countries, or aside from Argentina, were in the ICC. So it predates all of that stuff. We then had a run of playing ICC-sanctioned tournaments, which has now stopped. You know, they've reorganized it, and it's no longer a priority. So since then, we've reintroduced the South American Championships. We made it an annual tournament. Whilst the ICC stuff was going on, we're playing every 2 years. We've made it every year again now. So everybody's getting together. That's Peru, Chile, Brazil, and Argentina. At least once a year. Then we've also got kind of bilateral tournaments. So last year we were over to Brazil. Brazil will be coming over to Peru soon, hopefully. We had this little three tri-nation tournament up in Colombia. And hopefully Colombia will be coming down to the next South American Championships, which will be held in Chile next year. And that was kind of part of the thinking behind going up there as well, just to give them a little bit of a taste for it and hopefully encourage them to get involved. They're a good, they're a great way of getting everybody together and kind of exchanging stories and finding out what's worked in other countries and what hasn't worked. So they're very useful from a development perspective in that way. They're great because they concentrate, you know, they're fun to play in, of course. And they're great in that they sort of concentrate you in that that higher level of cricket and sort of concentrating on actually playing well and all that sort of thing. Because, you know, obviously in developing cricket country such as our own, the priority is always just getting everybody involved and making sure people enjoy it and making sure they come back and just grow in numbers all the time. So it's nice to have that as a, I wouldn't go as far as to call it elite cricket, but it's nice to have that little part of serious cricket, I guess. The youth South American Championships are, of course, a great indicator of development and how far we're coming along. And before Colombia came on the scene, we were kind of the last ones to get into the ICC. Well, Colombia aren't part of the ICC anyway. But so we've always been kind of playing catch up with Chile and Brazil particularly. So it's always good to measure ourselves against them. And as I say, to look at what they're doing and to try and copy some of their success stories. That's what we're trying to do with the Cricket Magdalena project. Actually, that's inspired by something they've been doing in Brazil. So those youth cricket tournaments are a great indicator, as I say, of progress. The men's, not so much, because often they'll hinge on the performance of a few expats who have played at a very high level at home. But they're definitely a big part of our cricket calendar and a great tradition and will remain so for many years to come, I think.
And what's the relationship with the ICC in terms of the South American Championships and these types of tours? Are they giving any assistance at all?
Yeah, a little bit. So we hosted the last South American Championships, which was in Easter this year. And a couple of guys, so the regional development officer and another guy came down from Toronto, which is where the America's office is. So they used that. We had a forum, basically a mini forum for development countries. So that was very useful to all get together. And as I say, it's kind of exchange best practice and all that sort of thing. They also ran a coaching course, which was very, very useful. So training people, basically like a train in the trainers course. So the people that took that course can then go and train local people out here and give them, you know, level one ICC coaching certificates. So that's been really useful because that means we can now go into schools and we can train local, you know, Peruvian PE teachers and have them incorporate cricket into their PE curriculum. They also helped out a little bit with umpires, I believe, in the past, although not so much at this tournament. But aside from that, not a great deal. And I think that's really... Obviously, the ICC has gone through a lot of changes these last 12 months, but kind of leading up to that, definitely the affiliate cricket is less of a priority for it, certainly you know, the most senior level, the executive level, and in terms of the finances that are available. But I would say our experience with the ICC office is actually, I don't know whether, and this may just reflect the change in staff or maybe something that the ICC is implementing globally, but we had a lot more support in terms of soft stuff. So advising us on programs and just kind of keeping the channels of communication open and, as I say, helping bringing people together and sharing experiences from Ireland, for example, or from Africa or whatever. Because ultimately, you know, developing cricket in Peru, all the problems, all the issues, challenges that we face have been faced elsewhere. So, I mean, it makes sense. We don't need to reinvent the wheel every time. And actually, that's been very useful to hear how other countries tackle these sorts of things. And I think going forward, that's likely to be their role, is going to be more of an advisor and a getter together rather than a financer.
The word from the ICC is that that's where they'd like to push as well. Does that mean that you don't see the path to these ICC events opening up anytime soon? Or would you like to still have that theoretically possibility to play in, say, the World 2020, even if it's a fairly remote one?
It's a tricky one. When they withdrew it a few years ago, it was very disappointing. And I know a lot of people, well, everyone kind of across the region was disappointed by it. It kind of been used as a carrot, I think, or it certainly was in our case, like an incentive, you know, come and get involved and do this, and this in terms of your domestic structures, and you can play international ICC sanctioned events, and as you say, you know, have a pathway to the World Cup. So to lose that was initially disheartening, because I think you lose that pathway. You kind of think, well, hang on, what happened to everything that you're saying? But now they've been very clear with us, they've been straight with us, and there is actually a way of getting back in, but we need to have a much bigger structure in place. And then if we have a proper representative youth teams, you know, one day in the future we can have men's teams as well. We're a long way off, you know, in terms of what they're asking for at the moment. We're a very long way off that. So I certainly don't see it in the short term, but, you know, by that I mean within the next 5 years. Beyond that, yes, there's every reason. I don't see why not. But who knows what the state of the ICC will be in 5 or 10 years, because, as I say, it's changed so much in the last year or two. So at the moment, as we look at it, you know, for Peru, it's a shame that we don't have this opportunity to play it, but it's not the end of the world. And our priority is getting Peruvians to play cricket. And I don't think actually that annual or biannual ICC tournaments would really stimulate organic domestic growth, really. So, fine, you know, we'll focus on that, and we're just trying to do the best job that we can in developing cricket in Peru and focusing on South America more so than the global picture or the Americas picture.
Right, that's all the questions I had. Good luck with the development, and hopefully we will catch back up with you and hear good things soon.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Fingers crossed. Send me an email first, though, right?
And sticking with the Americas region, the American Cricket Federation and finished their tournament, which we spoke about before it started, the Champions League, with their national championship, which they held in Florida. It appears to have gone off particularly well. There was a lot of sunshine and no rain, which is always a good start for any cricket tournament. The number of matches was fairly compressed within the tournament itself, and then slightly odd format, but the Florida All-Stars won over the Midwest Chargers in the final by a fairly significant margin of 218 runs, and most of the reports seem to be that the overall event went quite well, Andrew.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. Glorious sunshine and you know, pretty decent facilities, unlike, we should mention, the USACA National Championship earlier this year, which was as we discussed at the time, back in August, an absolute disaster, with matches being rained off and players not turning up for matches and whatnot. But this seems to have gone well, and I think it's been a successful first season. I think earlier on, perhaps there were a couple of teams that weren't taking it as seriously as others, and hopefully that will change next year. Also, hopefully they can maybe get some more leagues involved. There was a couple of ACF member leagues who didn't take part in the tournament this season. Hopefully they will next season. And it's good to see that they've completed a full season of a national cricket league in America. For the first time that's happened, really. There was pro cricket in 2004, which ran a full season but did have a lot of problems. So the American Cricket Federation has had a season-long national league in the US without any problems, and that is really something for them to be proud of.
Yeah, absolutely. And as far as we know, they're not bankrupt, which is definitely a step forward for anything that happens in the US after a completion of the season. And as we said, I think at the time that they started, they're willing to start small and grow it, and that's obviously the best way of approaching this type of thing, and so hopefully next season will be bigger and better.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's only one major tournament coming up in the next month or so, Andrew, and it's a fairly big one. It's World Cricket League Division 3. It's the last opportunity for any of these teams to work their way up into Division 1, and obviously the opportunities that affords. The six teams involved, as we know, the Bermuda in the USA from the Americas, Malaysia and Singapore, and Nepal from Asia, and Uganda from Africa. It's been moved from Uganda, as we discussed in the last episode, to Malaysia, which it probably has thrown early predictions up in the air a lot. And I think it was generally assumed that Nepal and Uganda would be pretty heavy favourites if it was played in Uganda as the home side and the strongest recent performer. Having it in Malaysia, and therefore having both Malaysia and Singapore playing in relatively familiar conditions, as well as some of the selections for the USA side, means that really this could go in any number of ways.
It's almost impossible for us to predict. I think the only team that we don't really fancy as a potential for promotion is Bermuda, who still seem to be picking a lot of the same players they've been picking for the last few years. They don't seem to be moving on much, which is disappointing for Bermuda. David Hemp isn't available for this tournament as well, and I think one of their coaching staff is missing the tournament due to an illness. And so Bermuda aren't looking too good. But the other teams, I think, as you say, I think almost any of them are capable of getting promoted. USA are perhaps the most interesting selection in the former West Indian international, Jermaine Lawson, who's been playing club cricket in New York in recent years. He's in the USA squad for this tournament. Just disappointed that, yet again, USA are having to rely on UNX West Indies international. But that's what happens when you don't bother trying to develop your own players, as the USA don't, because of their sort of disastrously run board, which we keep talking about. But USA with Jermaine Lawson, Steve Messiah is back in the side again. He's captain in the side again. There's some very talented players in the USA side. Stephen Taylor's still playing for the USA, which is good to see. USA could very well challenge, and I think the other teams as well. Nepal, you always back to do well in a tournament in Asia. And you say Malaysia and Singapore, and you're on familiar territory. And Uganda is still a very good side as well. Although Uganda, we saw in the Africa Cricket Association 50-over competition, tended to rely a little heavily on Roger Mukasa. And hopefully the rest of their side can step up and do something as well. I'm quite looking forward to this tournament. It's probably the most open World Cricket League tournament we've had in some time.
Yeah, I certainly agree. Bermuda seem to be in something verging on chaos in terms of players pulling out of the squad, and the local Royal Gazette is been fairly scathing of what's been going on there. So I think they certainly, as you said, that they're probably favourites for relegation. The USA, they're missing Tim Roy Allen, but other than that, they're pretty close to as strong a side that they've put out in a while. And they do tend to perform reasonably well in these tournaments. Certainly, they often start badly and then get going. So depending on how their preparation has gone, and as usual, doesn't seem to have been awesome, they have to be a threat. And any time you put a player in the side, depending on how fast Jermaine Lawson's bowling, but he used to be topping up close to 90, that really is going to... He could make a huge difference in 50-over cricket if he can get through 10 overs at high speed, even on pitches that maybe don't suit it.
Yeah, as we discussed with Amjad Khan in the Denmark side, that speed of bowling is not something that's very common at associate level, and a bowler like that can make a lot of difference to a side. Apparently, he's still bowling pretty rapidly in cricket in New York, and if he really genuinely is bowling rapidly, and he can do that on the pitches in Malaysia as well, and the USA could be a force to be reckoned with.
Because he's been known also for not necessarily always bowling as well, so which will be itself an interesting sideline to the tournament. But there might be his cameras watching him, so it's probably for the best.
Yeah, and the actions of a lot of associate bowlers sometimes leave a lot to be desired, it has to be said.
Looking at the fixtures, it will be Malaysia, Singapore in the opening match, in Bermuda, USA. So we may see, I think, whoever loses those two games, I think will have a really uphill task to finish up. And Malaysia and Nepal will be playing the final match of the tournament. So that as well will be a game which may end up being the deciding who gets through, and unless both teams have won all their games to that point.
Yeah, the scheduling of World Cricket League tournaments always seems to throw it up such that you've got a potential deciding match on the final day, which is always good to see. You'd hope that the ICC could learn for scheduling other tournaments that way. Unfortunately, they always seem to schedule a dead match on the final day of group stages and whatnot. But It should be, as I say, it's looking to be a very exciting tournament. But normally when we say that, it ends up being a really dull, predictable tournament. Hopefully we'll be wrong this time. Hopefully we'll be right this time.
we haven't picked a clear winner, so we can't be wrong on that score at the very least.
Yeah. I think we've learned from predicting anything, because we're just always wrong.
The Nepal fans will appreciate us not saying that they're guaranteed to go through so they don't get relegated.
Yes.
That's all we've got for this episode. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Chris, as always.